Hey, everybody, do me a favor. Welcome to Road Rash for the first time ever for our second ever episode of Road Rash. We have
for the first time ever for a second ever.
No, but it's the first time that he's here on our second ever.
Yeah, I gotcha, because he is a special one.
He is a special one. So he is a special one automatically. But so what we have for you guys today is we have a guy who, you know, we have people all over the country that we know and that we've become friends with through the years that are not only friends, but they're contacts, they're business associates for things that we do. And this guy is one of those guys. I consider Brad to be a good friend. We've talked for years. This is Brad Bohannon, who owns Spirits on Bourbon and Turtle Bay on Decatur down in New Orleans. Brad has been seen on the show Bar Rescue, if you remember correctly. Brad was the first person to stand up against John Taffer, the host, to basically, say, hey, hold on for a second, brother. I'm not that guy. You know, it was a great episode. It was one of my favorite ones. Brad and I have been friends ever since that episode. And Brad, dude, we are so totally stoked to have you here on Road Rash with us today.
Absolutely.
What's up?
It's another day in paradise, man. We got through our first technical bits. So everybody knows Russell and Brad and myself are not technologically advanced in every aspect. So we're doing this by ourselves until it gets into an editor's hands. But Brad, dude, I'm so glad to have you on, man. I really am. We have become friends over the last couple of years. And, Brad is one of those guys that he's a contact. He's a guy that if I have somebody who's going to New Orleans, I always text Brad and say, I have a friend going down. I don't just send anybody down to him. I send certain people to Brad because I know that Brad's going to take care of him. Brad, you had a big weekend with some friends of mine, man.
Oh yeah, you sent a couple of your girlfriends down there from Philadelphia, and then your boy Clay Guido, the carpenter, came down. And he got me a few times. So I was like,
game. Dude, Clay is a rock star. First off, let's clarify one thing. You said a couple of my girlfriends. Let's be specific about that. They are friends of mine who are girls.
Are they Tinder girls? Tinder girls?
No.
Yeah.
No, they're not Tinder girls. Deanna's a great chick. She's a lot of fun. She's a super cool chick. And then Clay Guida, who is the UFC fighter, also known as the Carpenter. And Clay is he's like the caveman, dude.
Nice. Let me tell you something. He's just a nice fella. I mean, he's just a good guy, and it's a good time all around.
Clay, I spent time in Cuba with Clay, and we had a great time. I'll tell you a really funny story real quick while we were down there. We're friends with the MPs down there, and one of the MPs walked up to us in the middle of standing on Guantanamo Bay, and he's like, hey, who do you guys want me to fuck with? And all of us, like, unanimously look over, and we're like, Clay? So he goes over. Clay was in the internet. We have like where we stay down there. There's a whole cluster of houses, and it's a little community. And the internet is completely horrible. For God's sakes, it's Cuba. And so he walks over to the internet house and knocks on the door with the dog, with the full on like drug sniffing, bomb sniffing military dog. And he walks in and he's like, sir, are you staying in house 32? And Clay kind of looks over for a sec. He's like, yeah. He's like, I was just doing my normal nightly rounds and my dog went a little bit nuts for drugs in your house. And Clay kind of looked around, and Clay's the nicest, cleanest dude there is. And his father, but the funny part is his father, Clay's father, who's retired Army, is sleeping in the house. And Clay's like, he just kind of stands up and he just looks over and he's like, all right, man, let's go. And he just like starts walking back, and now he's got to walk past all of us, and we couldn't even hold it in any longer. We just started busting out laughing, but the dog was like, he's holding the dog back, like the dog's starting to bark. And Clay's actually going to be on, Russell, I can't wait for you to talk to him, but that's enough of that. Hey, Brad, I really want to talk to you about spirits and, where you guys were and where you guys are today and what you attribute to a lot of that success.
Today I probably think, in my humble opinion, I think we're probably the most successful bar that the show's ever did.
Bam. That's awesome.
Wow. That's a huge statement, dude. And I love that statement.
I love it too. Yeah.
And that was kind of my goal at the end of the day. Whenever, even if they left, you talk to the producers, and I was like, before it came out, I go, at the end of the day, I want to be the guy. I want to make the best of this. Because I've been in the game for a long time, and like I tell you, I used to go to the nightclub and bar convention when John would speak in the little tiny room, and I always thought it was pretty inspirational. And when the opportunity came, when I felt like I could work with some of the best guys in the industry and like kind of look at things through different eyes, I was going to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to be that guy. You know, let me tell you, there's some things that the experts think that I don't think is right. I mean, you know, but there's stuff that I know that they can probably do better than me.
So
and
what?
I'm humble enough to do, you know, and to realize that. I've been stealing ideas my whole life.
You know what I mean? Dude,
well, you know, very, very few ideas out there in the bar industry seem to be original ideas anyway.
Yeah. I mean, but the thing is, at the end of the day, you can only cook chicken so many ways.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you got to find out the best. And, like, if they could raise Paul Perdone from the dead, Duffy, guess what? You'd go work with him and learn something from him. If you could spend
absolutely.
I mean, those guys are the innovators to me. And there's a different kind of a respect for them.
Hey, it's the most sincerest form of flattery. You know, it's imitation. That's the thing. It's what I always try to say to my clients and the people that I work with, we and Russell, obviously I'm talking about in my culinary world, but I say to everybody, we are not trying to recreate the culinary wheel. Yeah. What we're trying to do is to serve a quality product that we do maybe a little bit better than somebody else does. You know, I just wrote an article this morning for Nightclub and Bar talking about how to update your outdated menu. And Brad, you're going to be involved in this. All the three of us are going to be on a panel together at Nightclub and Bar, which we're going to talk about at the end. But I talk about the simple fact that we are not recreating the culinary wheel. Brad, you're in New Orleans, man. You got to serve a couple of things really great. And you've got to make sure that they're consistent, and that's the key to that.
Well, and the thing is, like, I'm in a kind of a trick bag with that because my wife is from Venice, Louisiana. She doesn't get any southern than that, and they cook seafood and gumbo, what they would consider the right way to cook it.
Yes,
I have the fine line of cooking it the right way and what people think it's like. So I got my wife, you know, barking at me for this way. So you know how that is.
Absolutely. Absolutely, dude. I mean, it's that whole idea. I mean, you know, the guest isn't always right, but we try to do our best to do that. And guess what? If 50 people walk into your bar and they say, hey, your gumbo doesn't taste as good as the guy down the street, and you go, well, you know what? But my wife likes it. They go, well, cool. Have your wife come in and buy 50 orders then. Because we don't like it.
I can't let my good taste get in the way of the stuff people will buy.
Exactly. I listen to people talk all the time. Well, I can't take grandma's meatballs off the menu. They're one of the biggest sellers we have on the menu. And I say, well, produce the numbers then. Show me the numbers.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Because guess
same
what? With
the cocktails. You know, the cocktails.
Exactly.
There's just roadmaps. All the recipes are just roadmaps for something that someone else already really created. I mean, there's very few original cocktails. And then on top of it all, we never make sure that we stand in the way from what customers want. You know, every bar that I did a consulting project on, they would have green chartreuse pina coladas all across the board. But if I let my taste come into play too much. But, you know, it's about pushing the numbers, pushing the volume, getting money in your hands.
Right. I told everybody I'd hate to own a breakfast restaurant because no one can ever cook eggs better than your grandma or your mother.
Yep.
You charge $10 for two eggs and they go, it costs 44 cents.
You know what I liked earlier, too, when you referred to yourself, Brad? Most people would say bag of tricks, but you called yourself a trick bag. I loved it.
Yeah, trick bag, yeah.
Guys, stick with me, guys. I'll bring you right to the middle. Come on, guys.
Striving for that 60%, my friend. Going right for the middle.
A little bit above average. That's
so, Brad, what is it really, I mean, what brought you into this part of the world? What brought you into this industry?
Well, I was working for all through college. And I was going to school in Missouri, and the weeks, and I'd work all year long. I'd work for Marriott, and I'm not that guy. I'm not like the suit and tie guy, but I was a horse. And I mean, I worked for Marriott, and I was busting my balls. And they're saying, graduate college, and you're gonna be a manager, and you'll be some big shot, wear a suit, and like, give me a color jacket, you know? I'll be big shit. So yeah. I got dyslexia. I can hardly read, so I'm like cheating, doing whatever I can to pass school, so I graduate. And I've been working. I've been working like you wouldn't believe.
As hard as your phone right now.
Yeah, like that's important. And so I was working. Then I finally graduated. I'm happy as can be. You know, it's like it was a big achievement for me. And then next thing you know, they gave that job to some intern. And I was like, oh, hell. And I was butthurt. I mean, I'm being honest. And so I had saved up a bunch of money. I had a whole $500 in my name. And my high school girlfriend was going to school at LSU, and I said, man, and we talked, we'd go back and forth all the time. I said, I'm going to go down there. And I never been on an airplane or nothing. It was like country come to town. And I moved down there with $500 and just got a job as a doorman and worked my way up to owning a third of a probably the most the biggest bar ever. You know, that probably by volume sells more than any bar, at least in the South.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
wow.
$100 and a bad attitude and, you know, kissing some ass and making some numbers where they had to let me in.
That's awesome, wow. Dude.
So, wow.
And where was this? Where was the first bar?
Well, I went at Tropical Isle. That's where I started that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what's the, okay, so after, and I just got to get this out of the way. Uh-oh. After years of, I mean, owning and running bars in New Orleans, one of the just the craziest cities in the world for partying, what's the craziest shit you've ever seen?
Oh,
or at least top three.
Yeah, oh my God, you can't stop it at one, Brad. You've got to go.
Yeah,
I think when I first moved down there, I was raw, man. I grew up in the Midwest. I didn't see a lot, and I remember I was sitting there and I used to work the day shift. I finally worked my way up. So I was a daytime bartender, and I'd hold court, boy. I mean, I would end up after you tell them.
I love you referring to it as holding court. It's so true.
Like, I'm not allergic to money. If someone has some money, I'm getting in that pocket all the way to that ankle right there. And I knew if I could entertain these guys, I could make money. I'd make more money than all of them. I didn't want to work at night because I had to share it, and I couldn't talk. And, you know, I get diarrhea of the mouth. Blah, 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 you know, and people like it because they're on vacation. They just want a friend. And so there's this older couple up there, and they go to the bathroom. And I'm doing it. I'm holding it up because I knew I was going to get their money. And they go there, and they open that door in the bathroom. And boom, they walk out, and they walk right out. I'm like, what the hell? I thought someone probably, like, threw up all over there. So I'm, like, done over there in my khaki shorts walking over there. And I open the door, and this guy's, like, laying the wood to this other dude on the ground. Like, in the bathroom. I'm like, I ain't never seen that before. And so I was just sitting there at the door going, dude.
Oh, God.
And so I was like, okay. So I just go back, and I go back there to the bar. I'm like, okay, what am I doing? You know, they run the other two customers off. So here they come. They sit at the bar, order a drink. I'm like, well, might as well get their money too. So that's probably like most of the off the wall kind of thing. I'll be totally off guard. I don't know if it was two guys or them on the floor after a Saturday night escapade there. That was pretty bad.
The worst.
A Tinder date gone right.
Now, how long have you been on bourbon?
Since 1996.
Wow, dude! So you're coming up on 20.
Yeah, I'm old school. I've been there long enough. They don't know any different. They accept me a little bit better than most.
And what do you see? I mean, what changes? I mean, there's massive changes that have happened in the last 20 years. But what do you think? What do you think one of the biggest changes? You know, what do you think the biggest changes are?
I think the biggest changes is probably a processing of credit cards. I remember when I first started out, I mean, we might have 5% credit cards. Now it's probably 65-70% credit card. I mean, that kind of stuff that people are getting more tech savvy with their money. And, you know, they're just not – the cash isn't there like it used to be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Right.
I'm amazed at how much credit. I don't think in 20 years we're going to have cash. I think we're going to be paying each other by our phone.
Dude, it's Bitcoin, man.
At the end of the day,
it's coming down to Bitcoin. I mean, and you know what's funny? I was in New York a couple of weeks ago doing Food and Wine, and when I had finished, I had walked over to get my car, and I handed the guy my credit card. And he's like, it's not working. It's not working. And I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? It's not working. Well, he's using the new chip that's in the cards.
The new chip, yeah.
Well, like 50% of the time, the chip doesn't even work anymore.
Yeah, so, and what sucks about that chip thing, too, is that they literally, you know, they changed it over this first of the year. Most of the banks, the credit cards did, and credit card companies. And when I was traveling, and I haven't been able to pick up my new cards. So I've been running without a chip, and now it's to the point where I'm, like, having to go back to a mailbox to pick up my cards with the chip.
Yeah.
Right.
But not only that, but the transaction now is slowing down. I mean, it used to just be a swipe. I mean, I was at Rite Aid the other day, and I'm standing in line. There's 15 people behind me. There's one girl working behind the counter, and I swipe my card, and the girl's like, no, you have to put the chip in. And I turned around, and I just kind of made a face, and I looked at everybody behind me, and they're like, don't worry, we'll wait. Like, everybody knows it just takes longer now, because now it's a 10-second transaction.
Because, I mean, you've been to Europe. They've been using it in Europe for years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You go over there, so they know the system. There's a reason why they wanted to do. I don't know if it's for safety or they know the cash thing is going to go away and they just want to, you know, just be more protective on everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's supposed to protect the personal information, not necessarily protect the cash and like people from hacking into it, but the actual personal information that's on the card.
Yeah.
But they've been working with it longer than we have. We're I think the United States is a little bit behind with it.
Huh.
Oh, very. You think?
You think? Just a little?
Yeah.
You know, we're afraid. I mean, we don't like change, man. We talk about having change all the time, and we voted for change, and we did all this stuff. But in reality, we don't like change. We like things just to kind of stay the same, you know? So
it's very interesting about that, too, though, is that to me, culturally, Europeans are a little more patient than the Americans. So I'm curious on how that patience is going to play in here and when we're going to see all the pop-ups of people like really complaining about this chip and the speed of service, you know?
But I've been doing a lot of stuff like you doing some public speaking, and then I got to work with this group called Woodwork, and they do all the accounting and like software with QuickBooks and stuff like that. And I got lucky enough to do their systems, and I just shot there like that. They did 10 episodes for all their accountants, and they gave me all their new computer systems, so all the new stuff that's coming out. And they got some new stuff, like everything's going to like iPads and iHands, and I think for like waiters and stuff like that, I think it's going to speed up. And I think bartenders it will too. I just think they got to figure out some way to have those things on the bar and they're effective. You know, how would you like, Russell, if you didn't even have to touch the money? They just swipe it and it's done like that.
I'm already thinking of ways how you could hide the chip swiping machines actually underneath the bar top where the hooks or the everything else is, to where the customer could just. my wheels are already turning on how you could make that happen.
It's just basically you order the drinks, you know, it tells them they order from there just like anything else. Boom, you're making that drinks, you're bringing that. You got time to do your show, you do your shindig, it's paid. The gratuity's on there, and you kiss babies, and you go on to the next drink.
Absolutely. Yeah. You're focusing on the service. You're doing the service. That's the key. I love that.
I think if that's going to be, that's where it's going to be. And then it takes all the pressure of the money part away from it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but now we're talking about, you know, having cleaner hands, cleaner operations because of the fact that we're not, you know, handling the cash going directly to a drink, handling this. I mean, in New York for a while, they were talking about bartenders wearing single-use gloves.
Well, I was one of the guys that first went on the some of the national radios and was fighting against the single-use glove policy that was supposed to be enacted in California as of January 1 of last year. And because everyone realized that by having these gloves on for these people that were handling money, you're actually creating more of a problem on cost of the gloves being thrown out per transactions or customer or actual employees just not changing them and handling money and then – literally these gloves becoming civilizations of just bacteria and just grossness, you know, and they pulled that back real quick.
Right. It doesn't make sense. I mean, there's nothing better than just cleanliness and washing your hands over and over and over
and over and over and over again. And this is to me, I would love to not have to handle money to an extent, you know. It also makes things a little bit different though for some of the employees in certain states, and this is just a very knowing and observing the industry, cash typical employees, it seems like, pay less because they don't declare all of their monies as opposed to people when you're tipping in credit card and that way.
Yeah.
So what you're going to see is you're going to actually see a more legal and better way of bartenders doing business because they will be declaring what they're making. The taxes will be paid. And it'll actually make their lifestyles easier because they'll be able to prove how much income they have as opposed to avoiding paying taxes with their cash tips and then not being able to get a loan for a house when they want one.
Agreed.
The biggest thing with service, they work so hard on not making money. And at the end of the day, they do all this stuff, and then they're renting their apartment forever, and they never have any opportunity to build wealth.
Yep.
And it's a choice. At the end of the day, if you're going to live a nice lifestyle, you've got to learn how to build wealth. I've got friends that were bartenders that have made a lot of money.
Yeah.
They invested it, and they were, you know, they didn't go out afterwards and blow their $200 they made every night. They were disciplined in it. Like me, every day I had an envelope. I had everything put out there. Mm-hmm. And then once that was it, then I had a little play money. And if I didn't make it, I got to make up it for the next day.
Yeah.
Until this industry gets that, you know, they're going to have a hard time. They're not going to have all these rock stars.
Well, you know, what's interesting, too, is that it kind of perpetuated itself into this awful thing because, you know, what it seemed like a lot of bar owners were trying to avoid when I was specifically beginning my days in the industry was they would pressure you not to declare all of your tips because then they would have to match the taxes that you paid on that. And so it was very interesting because you had these bar owners that were trying to, you know, not do things fraudulently, basically, and pushing this attitude onto their employees, which then just perpetuated itself to employees always not declaring as much on cash tips and just becoming this policy. And you'd see them train new bartenders and saying, well, you don't necessarily declare all these cash tips. Right. And then the next thing you know, they can't prove their income to get a credit card or to get a loan and do these things that make life necessary. So yeah, I'm totally agree with this. And you've seen it a lot because, I mean, you've seen a lot of cash handled over those bars in Bourbon Street.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's just discipline. I think you got to wake up and choose to. You're going to be a successful person, and I mean, you can make a lot of money in this industry, and you can blow a lot of money.
Yeah. Hey, Brad, what are your thoughts on the, you know, Russell and I had a pretty in-depth debate today, not even a debate, because I think we both are in the same boat or the same kind of camp of what are your thoughts about the idea of removing the tipping policy, you know, and going directly to a $15 an hour wage for hospitality employees?
I mean, but the thing, I don't think hospitality employees are going to be happy with that. You know, at the end of the day, there's a reason why they like it. They like the quick money. I think there could be some standards put on there where, you know, where they're guaranteed to make a certain amount of money. You know, like now that you pay them $3 an hour, but if at the end of the month that they don't make that $15 an hour, maybe. But if they can't make that an hour, they probably shouldn't be doing what they're doing anyway.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's how I look at it.
I mean, how would it impact your business?
Oh, if there were no, at the end of the day, I probably would make more money. I mean, I'm just telling you, I don't think.
Yeah, no, but it's actually nice to hear that you would be against it, even though you would make more money on it, because I totally agree that it takes some entrepreneurial endeavors to make more money out of the service industry workers' hands when they do it this way. So.
If somebody wants to put their phone in their pocket, that could probably stop the vibrating. Brad! Mr. Bohannon! MO2 NOLA! Yeah.
Russell does this to me every time. Phone in my pocket.
For those of you who want to know, Brad still carries a Nokia.
Yeah.
For those of you who want to know, Brad still has a Nokia in his pocket.
My go phone's here. But I think at the end of the day, I don't think it's the right thing to do at this point. I just don't. I mean, I think I can make more money. I'm very strict. I tell my employee, I have a meeting with each one of them individually every month. I said, this is what I want. This is what I expect. This shift right here makes this amount of money with or without you. So you can either get this done or it doesn't work. I want 8% of appetizers. I want 3% in merchandise sales, and if you can't provide this, I'm going to find someone that does. I never fire nobody; they fire themselves.
and Brad, that's that's one of the things that I like about you is the fact that you hold your employees to a standard. You know, I just had a conference call last week with employees with one of my clients where I said, "You as bartenders and you as servers are it's like working in a car dealership. If you're not selling enough cars, guess what? You're gone." Because all you're doing is taking up space on my floor. You're an independent contractor that's working for me at this point. And Brad, it's one of the reasons why I expect you, because you have full disclosure with your employees. I need to make 25 grand today, or I have to ring this amount. That brings it down to you doing this, you doing this, you doing this. The employees have their expectations, and there's no questions about what it is that they have to do. And that's one of the reasons why I respect you, because you tell the truth, dude.
And in general, people want to please.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't know what to do to please you.
Yeah. So and help them.
I have contests like every month. Like, okay, I'm a merchandise guy because I think there's a value. Like, if I ever want to be like Trader Joe's, or I want to be like Eskimo Joe's in Oklahoma, where no one's ever heard of, but you see their hats and stuff all over. I've got to push that merchandise.
Yep.
And like, it's not, if they can do it, I can do it because I got a better spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Like, this is what I want. I go, I got guys like someone will sell 118 t-shirts and one will sell six. So what's the problem here?
Yeah.
I'm not saying you got to be the 118 guy, but I expect you to be the 50.
Have you, Brad, ever done the off my back contest? You give your five bartenders behind the bar. Each one of them has five t-shirts they have to wear. They got to sell them off their back.
Oh, okay.
You sell them right off your back, man, because you know what? There's a group of five guys that are coming in that are doing shots, and that hottie behind the bar, she's going to take her t-shirts off for him. Now, granted, she's got something underneath of them, and I'm all for sex sells, and she's going to have something underneath of that, but you're getting what I'm saying. I mean, we got it. We have to do what we have to do to get the product out there. We have a bar in the suburbs of Philadelphia called Jake's. Jake's is a dive that's in Westchester, Pennsylvania. But guess what? When I was in Italy in Catania 2 years ago, I saw a guy standing on the steps of a 3,000-year-old building wearing a Jake's t-shirt.
Yep. People pay for it to advertise for you. You can't beat that. That's
exactly. That's, and they're paying exactly.
And especially with
you're throwing money against the wall. I mean, you don't know what you're getting out of it, but that you know, that's someone that liked your place enough to invest $25 in it.
Absolutely.
And with social media being the way that it is these days, you could literally do anything with that media that's published from people taking pictures with that t-shirt, with what you put on the t-shirt, all sorts of different challenges and opportunities to market yourself for free once the product's out there too.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I used to do something at the end at one of my bars. We were on a college campus and we used to do a $5 sandwich. So at the end of the day, we'd take some leftover food that we had, nothing that was bad. It was just, you know, we would kind of put stuff aside. And I'd say, I need you to make me 25 sandwiches tonight because we have a crowd on a Thursday night. And they'd walk into the bar. And at the end of the night, we stood outside with the t-shirt with our sandwiches that were wrapped in paper and then plastic. Next to that was a bottle of cold water. And then we wrapped it inside of one of our t-shirts that we did. You paid $5 for a sandwich. You walked out the front door. Guess what? How many people are now walking down the street wearing one of my t-shirts that I just gave you? And you're not drunk and loaded. And you're not going to the pizza place at the bottom of the steps. Because I just gave you a $5 sandwich that I got rid of product. You know, who cares if it was a 50 or 60% food cost? I got rid of that product that now is not going to sit in my walk-in and go bad. And you're wearing my t-shirt everywhere you go now.
Right. I fight with I got some buddies in the bars and like, I had one out here in in the suburbs, and it's a different ball game. You got to, you know, discount stuff. And but I tell them, I go, you can't discount, give the food away and the liquor.
Yeah.
Because all you're doing is diluting this market. There's money out here. You're ruining it for everyone else. I mean, you can have a $5 sandwich, but you can't have a dollar beer with it.
You know, it's a shame that there's not enough people that are like you within the college world, you know, that are out there that really have the balls to say that sort of stuff. You know, like where in reality, I mean, you're saying you're diluting our market. We have the opportunity to charge $5 a beer because they're going to pay for that. But you wanted to undercut me. So now you're going $4. Now the guy down the street's going $3.
And guess now, what? You rung $4,000 and lost $200.
Yeah.
And I run $600 and made $300.
Yeah.
Bam. Yep.
I mean, that's simple. Math, guys. I tell them it's a math.
Now, now, what is your, I mean, of all of your beverage sales, I mean, how much of that are attributed to your signature cocktail that you guys are serving down there?
That's probably 30%.
Really? And what's the mix coming from the other things? I mean, what other kinds of drinks? I mean, on Bourbon Street, I mean, this is literally the pulse of what's going on. I mean, you're the party capital of our country.
Yeah, right. And more bars, restaurants, and nightclubs per capita there than anywhere else in the country, right?
I mean, it's the major leagues of, you know, I really wouldn't, there's very other places that I would even consider even doing once I've did this, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
I mean, you kind of threw yourself in the thick of it, quite frankly.
Go big or go home.
I want them to have my specialty drinks. I want them taking my cups home. I want them in their cabinets at the colleges. That's so. I mean, like I'm a beer man's worst nightmare because I'm trying to sell my drinks. I don't like them having the beer sign, the Bud Light, and the Miller Lite signs in there. I want my product there. I want my sign there. I'm building my brand, and that's something these bars they're so worried about. Oh, I want to get me the Bud Light Neon. Screw the Bud Light Neon. Get your drink own sign there. That's your space. That has a value of them looking at.
It's your real estate.
Put that neon there.
You guys and I feel like from an image standpoint too, you know, one, they should be paying you to put their neon up there, you know, not feeling so empowered just because I got a free, you know, this beer company's neon. But also I feel like depending upon the concept and the environment that you're trying to build in these bars, that you almost become looking like a sellout with too much branding.
Well, let me tell you something. I mean, if I'm selling out and I'm making a whole bunch of money doing it,
That's fine. That's fine.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
Like, at the end of the day, if I got to have my pictures of my drinks everywhere, all the wall and other Bud Light, and I'm building my brand, I'm doing it. Because that's what they're doing. They're doing it at a higher level. And I'm just going to knock at it. I'm getting that money. And if they're they're going to take my space, I'm getting something out of it.
So to kind of switch gears here real quick, but kind of staying on the same page, because, you know, to me, New Orleans is this town where we have these feelings of what we need to do when we go there. I go to New Orleans every year, except for last year, for sometimes twice a year, but every summer for the Tales of the Cocktail Bar Industry Convention, which is held in July. And it's just an amazing thing that's grown. And we'll talk more about that here in a minute, because I think we should do something there. But, you know, to me, New Orleans is defined by me making sure that I go to Felix's and have some oysters with an Abita beer standing there, bellied up against the bar. I have to have a beignet from Café du Monde. I have to have a Sazerac and a Ramos Gin Fizz from the Carousel Bar at the Hotel Monteleone. I have to go have a shot of Irish whiskey with Brad over at Spirits on Bourbon. What to you is the quintessential make, and from a local standpoint, makes New Orleans, New Orleans?
Well, New Orleans to me is the closest thing to being out of the country and still being able to be in the United States.
I couldn't agree more.
It's the feel, it's the walking, it's that's what makes New Orleans, New Orleans to me. It's a southern state where everything is behind everything, but they're a lot more open than any place else in the South. You know? Like social issues, they're more accepting here before it's accepted even in the more liberal places. If you are like a cast out, you can come here and be somewhat normal. And it's a nice feeling.
For, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And you can't make that overnight. And that was just for years and years of, I think, outcast being there and accepted and kind of making their way and just not, and like, you know, they tell you to stay in your lane. You know, the lane here might be a dirt road, you know, so, but it's still a good lane. So, and it works, what works here may not work anywhere else.
Yeah. What specifically are some of those things that you feel like work that don't work anywhere else?
Oh, I mean, you know, we've just got our advantage because, you know, our party's on the street. I make more money sometimes when no one's in the club. Coming and going, you know what I mean? Because you know, like, that's an advantage that I have that I think is really cool. People enjoy that. The essential stuff. What I do if I was to come to New Orleans?
Well, I mean,
asking me?
Yeah,
maybe you say the sexual stuff. Yeah, I want to hear.
Yeah,
it.
You know, whatever my wife will let me do, that's what I'll do. You know? Whatever I can talk her into after a couple of drinks.
I mean, to me, it's just that the city is just full of these things that really just embody what the city is. And then on top of it all, have things that just pump out a product that make a bunch of money. You know, you've got your cocktails, you know, Felix's has their oysters that are just literally coming across the bar nonstop. I mean, these guys are just shucking them and throwing them out there. You know, a Carousel Lounge, I don't think they ever stop pumping out Sazeracs or you know, Café du Monde with their beignets and their chicory coffee. To me, these are not only just, like, staples that are New Orleans, but also just have a product that's just getting out there and is just as much part of their brand as what they've created for themselves.
New Orleans, to me, is, like, the cool kid that's not that trendy. You know what I mean? It's like, we're not, like, the other cities are, like, to me, is, like, it's like past blue ribbon. These guys are drinking that because they don't want to be trendy, but they're drinking it and it makes them trendy.
Yeah.
We're not
that, you know?
Yeah.
You're not what Austin's become, Austin, Texas, which I love Austin, Texas. And after Hurricane Katrina, you know, right afterwards, we became, I was in learning how to, or I was bartending on 6th Street during Hurricane Katrina. So we had a lot of the refugees from the bartenders in NOLA come out that direction. And we took the brunt of a lot of that business. And it seemed like the combination of that meets whatever else was going in Austin made a very trendy town. So I almost feel like the type of town you're talking about is kind of like Austin, Texas. Right.
Hey. We're like Austin, Texas without all the rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's forgiving.
Lines too much.
Hey, Brad. So I mean, you're a traveler as well. I mean, you're no stranger to getting out there and doing that sort of stuff. But if I'm coming to New Orleans, I mean, I know the first phone call that I'm making is to you before I even book my flight, just to make sure that you're in town that weekend. I mean, that's the way that's going to happen. But where are you going? I mean, where are you going other than home to have, you know, your wife's gumbo? But where are you going to? Where are you going to have something to eat? Where are you getting your, you know, your po' boy? Where are you going to get your gumbo? Where are you getting your muffaletta? Where are you getting, you know, whatever it is that you're going to get?
I like Adolfo's over on Frenchman Street. It's right above the Apple Barrel. The chef, he just fell off the boat. They got red wine or white wine, and they got like 3 or 4 options. It's real, like, kind of gritty, but the food, it's like great Italian food, authentic, and it's. It's small. I like the quaint place. I don't like all the noise sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a Paul Perdone fan. You know, I think he's one of the most underrated chefs. I think he's the one that made chefs famous.
He was. Absolutely.
I think he kind of got lost in the shuffle a little bit. At the end of the day, if there wasn't Paul Perdone, I mean, the chefs wouldn't be who they are now. Well, he's the one that made chefs superstars to me.
Who was the Cajun chef? Who was that? What was his name again?
Well, Paul Perdone was the one that took it like a PBS, and then
yeah, but who was that?
Come on,
hey Cajun, guarantee. And I don't know if a lot of people remember that guy, but he was PBS, man. He was the Cajun chef. He was what was his name?
Man,
hold on, let me go in right here. I got him right here. My man's name. My name was Justin Wilson, Cajun chef Justin Wilson. And he was the guarantee guy. He was the guy who would stand there, and he was the original. I hate to say it. I mean, look, we can talk about Jacques Pepin. We can talk about Julia Child. We can talk about Martin Yan, and we can go that way. We can talk about Emeril Lagasse, who has literally kind of adjusted his career to match where he is right now. But Justin Wilson was the Cajun chef. Everybody get a chance. Hop on YouTube. Go to Google. Just Google up Cajun chef Justin Wilson. He's a blast to watch because he the way that he speaks and his mannerisms and his love for the simplicity of the food of that region is just unmatched. You know?
And I'm going to go off on a limb here because I've never really thought about this before, but he really was kind of one of the first people to brand themselves as a chef, wasn't he?
Yep.
And then Paul Perdone kind of took it to the next level with making all the blackened food and learning how to market the spices.
Brad, I don't know if you know, what do you call his spice? Does anybody know what you call his spice? I'll tell you from the industry what we call it. Anybody know?
No.
It's called Fat Man Spice. Because Paul Perdone was the guy who came out with the original blackening spice mixture. And from that blackening spice mixture came the McCormick's Cajun spices, came all these different spices that followed. Emeril's Bam and all of his products, the essences, were all a derivative of that original, you know, that original spice that was coming out. I mean, those were the things that were being pulled out. I mean, so Paul Perdone, this guy was an entertainer, you know, and he had a really tough run towards the end with his weight, with the disease and everything that came from obesity with him. I mean, I remember watching him on the Today Show once, and the poor guy was in a wheelchair. But he was in a wheeled chair that had to get him across. I mean, you know, that was a big deal. I mean, and he kind of got pushed a little bit by the wayside by a couple of the bigger names that were coming out with the Emeralds, who really took over the entertainment end of the things and really launched what it is that term, quote-unquote, celebrity chef took over. But Justin Wilson, that man was a full-fledged rock star. Right. I loved him. Guarantee.
You go to like K Paul's and the kitchen staff, they get the pans out there and they're all singing "You Are My Sunshine." It's kind of an experience. It's a fast-paced kitchen, but at the end of the day, they're still having a pretty good time.
Yeah, man, that's the way it should be. I worked with a guy years ago who worked at the blackening kitchen at Commander's Palace, I guess.
Oh yeah,
you know, and I always tell my guys, like, look, man, look, blackening is a spice. It's not just a color. It's a seasoning. It's not just a color. You know, and I remember working with this guy years ago at a place in Philadelphia, and he would stand there, and we'd be coughing. you know, because of the fact that we've got somebody's got a blackening, they got the cast iron pan out, they're rocking and rolling, doing the whole nine yards, and he'd just be standing there looking at us like we were jackasses. He's like, man, I worked in a blackening kitchen in New Orleans. That's all we did was blacken. It was that simple. He's like, you get used to it, you know. So there were some pretty cool stories that came out of this guy, especially talking about the Paul Prudhomme's, the Emeralds, the Justin Wilsons, and those sort of things. So
Anders is probably one of my favorite restaurants. I got lunch there. You got $2 martinis. It's kind of like an uppy-uppy. That's probably one of my must-sees. I like Arno's, Antoine's. I mean, the food is good. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, you're the best food town in the United States, arguably, besides, you know, San Francisco or New York.
Gave chefs. They were famous in New Orleans before chefs were famous anywhere else.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. They were the ones who originally started the whole world of that. And I'll tell you what, one of the coolest parts about New Orleans cooking, about Louisiana in itself, is that it's unlike anything else that we do anywhere else in the country. It is its own world. It is its own world of what we do.
The oldest bar in the U.S. is there. It's the birthplace of the American cocktail. The first true cocktail was invented in New Orleans, the Sazerac, in 1836.
Wow.
It is literally like the culinary just hot spot for the U.S.
Yeah.
And like, no. You know, Besh is like really lighting it up. And I think Besh, I like his style because I think Besh cooks at his restaurant like his mom cooks.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think he's like your favorite uncle. You know, when you meet him, you know, I went and had dinner with him the other day, and it was just like, he's doing some really good things, and he's going to go a long ways, I think.
But, you know, one of the cool parts about Besh is the fact that he has that low country world of cooking that he does and that homey, comforty stuff. But when you look at him, he's a polished executive chef. He is that definition. He's a good looking dude. Tall, statuesque in the way that he walks and the way that he commands his kitchens, the way that he walks in, his presence is unmatched. But he's that good looking
beautiful guy. Beautiful chin.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, chin. He's not the Emeril who was good at what he did and had a catchphrase. He wasn't the Paul Prudhomme who had his fat man spice and did all the other stuff. Besh, in my opinion, was one and is one of those chefs who deserves a full accolade on a culinary level for what it is that he does, because he brought it to another level. I think some of those other guys brought some awareness to what was going on and they nailed what they were doing, but he is stepping outside of the box and he's bringing it to a different level. There,
like,
I said it.
Guys have, like, I call hot stuff. It's hot.
Yeah.
But like everything he does is warm and it's just consistently great.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's the key to success is consistency.
It's hard to like, compete with your mom's cooking. You're never going to do it, but he can because he feels like he gives her the props of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, well, some
of the chefs forget about that, you know, that you got to throw it back, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So Brad, let me ask you this. I mean, we've been talking for about 45 minutes and you know, we don't want to kill the listeners with every single part of it, but let me ask you this. What advice as somebody who is as involved in the industry as you are right now, who's been in it, who's coming on a 20-year anniversary, who owns properties, who markets like nobody that I've ever seen before, who does a hospitality like nobody I've ever seen before. What advice can you give to the people that are listening that want to do what it is that you're doing on the level that you're doing?
I think it's pretty simple. I mean, you know, I remember like reading like Rich Dad, Poor Dad and like just playing the percentages of like, you know, if you're married or you're with the same wife, if you do all this stuff right and it's a job, I mean, it's not, I get it. There's fun and it's easy to get caught up in it. And you're laying the broads, the hot broads are laying on you, get the drugs and the drinking. If you can take this and you can be that guy that can make it, this is your living and you do it like that, you can make a ton of money because your competition most of the time doesn't do that.
Yeah.
So yep. You have that great advantage. I mean, you don't have to be the best shooter. You just have to put yourself in the best shot to succeed. And if I'm sitting out here and I'm laying all the bartenders or all the hot broads that come in, I start doing drugs, I'm shooting 5%.
Yeah.
If I'm over there, I'm putting myself underneath the basket, I'm shooting 90%.
Yeah.
So I keep myself straight. It's a job. I do this. I go to work every day. That way I don't have to have a real job.
Wow.
You know, that's the way I look at it. And it's not being the best. It's just being the best that you can be. And you know, what John Wooden used to say, success is doing the best that you can do. And at the end of the day, that's all I can do. And I can do it straight, and I got to show some honor and respect to my family. Don't worry, I fall off, and I've got myself, my wife batted an old wet hen. Russell came down one time, didn't come home one night.
That was a fun night. That was a fun night. But that was during Tales of the Cocktail, too, wasn't it?
Yeah. At the end of the day, you got to choose to do the right thing. You got to choose. It's a choice. You got to make to be the best business guy to make money.
I had a friend of mine who opened a college bar, and he's a good looking dude. And he came to me one day and he's like, Duff, I'm having trouble. He's like, I have these 21-year-old waitresses who are hitting on me at the end of the night, coming into the office, doing their cash out. He's like, they're sitting down, they're starting to take their shirts off, their work shirts off, and they're in sports bras and they're looking at me. And one girl's touching my leg the other night. And I said, look. He said, I got to a point that now I have to have two people in the office with me at any time because of the fact that I'm very uncomfortable, you know, sitting in front of this. He said, and I'm having a hard time. And I said, look, you can be, here's the way. You can be that guy who is the awesome owner of the bar that everybody loves to work with and everybody wants to fuck, or you can be that dick that banged the waitress.
Right.
So make the choice. So.
All right. And it's like, it's pretty simple. And that's, if you can stay straight. The good thing about this industry, most of your competition isn't going to stay straight.
Yep.
And like, you're fighting the drunk guy.
Yeah.
You got a pretty good chance to win, but you have to. It's a hard to do because you get caught up in it, and you got to sit there and figure it out. It's either you're going to go at the end of the day, you can do this for 10 years and have nothing, and then have to go start over again, or you can go there and make a lot of money and be rich.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it feels so much better to just do good business wisely and properly too. You know, it's something that helps you sleep better at night.
Yeah. Well, you know, hey, Brad, I want to thank you very much. I know Russell and I were real excited to have you on just because we knew we were going to have a candid conversation with you and we were going to get some info at the same time. You know, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day and coming on and hopping on with us. And we'd love to have you back. And so that everybody knows, Russell and I are both really excited to be able to hang out with Brad out in Vegas. We'll see everybody out there March 7th, 8th, and 9th at the Nightclub and Bar Show. The three of us will be on a panel. We're going to be discussing, you know, just some of what's been going on in the world and the industry and all the fun stuff. So we're excited to see you out there.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast again this year, man. It's going to be fun to get back out there and for all of us to see each other and hang out, man. Brad,
I tell people that's a convention. They go, oh, it's a lot of money or it costs us. I mean, it doesn't cost you anything because it will make you money if you go there and then you go to the seminars and you go and learn. All it takes is one thing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. One thing.
One idea.
It's $1 million idea.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Look at and learn from all these other guys' mistakes.
Yeah.
Learn from them. You don't have to make these mistakes anymore. They're already been made. Check your ego to the side. Look and see what everybody else is doing and go make that money.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, hey, Brad, why don't you do me a favor? Why don't you tell us how everybody who's listening to you right now can get in touch with you and how to follow you?
I'm at MO2NOLA on Twitter at Bohannon Brad. On Instagram and Brad Bohannon on Facebook. And you can always check me out at Spirits on Bourbon or Turtle Bay in New Orleans on their Facebook page, too. And I look forward to seeing you guys in Vegas.
Yeah, man.
Hey, you too, man.
It's going to be a good one.
Maybe before that, we got to work something out.
Yeah, I think we need to do something for Tails this year. I think we need to figure out something. So
when is Tails?
Tails will be in July this year. I'll have to check the dates for sure. But, yeah, we just have to. We have to, guys.
That's grown huge.
Yeah, I mean it's become the biggest nightclub and bar, or excuse me, the biggest cocktail convention in the world. You know,
all the cool guys like Russell go there.
I know. I've never been. I'm not that cool yet, man.
Yeah, Brian, we don't fit in there, but we'll just say I'm with Russell Davis. That's what I do. I'm with Russell.
Yeah, that's it. Clear.
Yeah, who the fuck is Russell Davis? I know.
Oh, no, he's that guy who's wearing all black, right? He's the guy wearing all black. We got him. Yeah, no, he's in here. He's the one with everybody around him right now because he's telling a story. That's fucking Russell right there. We know who he is.
Oh, he's the one drinking the green chartreuse. Almost passed out.
So, all right. Well, Brad, dude, we can't wait to see you in Vegas. We are so excited. We're going to see you out there Sunday night. We're going to probably hopefully get out and get to a dinner. And then we are in the process right now of looking to hook up for a Road Rash podcast that we're going to do live from a not yet to be disclosed location. We haven't had the final contract come through, so we're going to find that out in a little bit. We've been working with our buddy, Brad. We know you know who Shane Hamilton is out there with Vegas Republic. We're looking to do a big event on the last night of nightclub and bar after everybody else is done partying. And when the real winners want to hang out with us, we're going to be doing a fun little Road Rash Live podcast. We'd love to have you out there with us to chill with us and have a couple of cocktails.
I look forward to it. Let's make it happen and have a good time and make some people some money.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Believers believe.
All right, Brad. Dude, thank you so much. We're so stoked to have you out. And we'll talk to you later, man. Be safe, dude. Okay, so I felt that we talked so much shit about Tinder that I should give it an opportunity. Okay, so what I did was I expanded my reach a little bit, Russell. I went from a 10-mile radius to a 14-mile radius.
No, of course you did. Of course you did. And at 14 is a random number.
Well, but I live in Philadelphia. So you know, 14 miles is a big deal. That's a big deal. Like, that takes you out towards, like, Pottstown. Like, there's a whole bunch of weird people that live out there.
Ladies and gentlemen, Brian Duffy is breaking Tinder boundaries right now. Tinder boundaries.
Yep, I went for it, dude. I hit the whole 14 because my whole process is, look, I don't want to drive 15 miles to go meet somebody. Sorry. You know, at least my car, man. I can't put that many miles on it. But I'll drive 14, exactly. That's a 28-mile round trip, you know? There you go. You can meet halfway. You can meet halfway and you're stoked. You know, you go 7 miles out. You're good. So I'm within my boundaries.
But you still haven't met anyone yet.
No, not at all. I actually had a woman today.
I'm excited for that one.
I actually had a woman who messaged me today and told me that where she lives, which is really in a very far area from where I live. And I almost was going to say no, but I remembered that I'm trying to open my horizons a little bit, expand them. So I didn't reply to her fast enough. And she replied with, "Well, I guess you don't have an answer." And I replied with, "Delete." So, you know what? I have a job and a family and a life that I can't reply that fast to stuff sometimes. So guess what, Tinder chick? Adios.
Yeah, and you could tell exactly where that's going to lead to. That's going to lead to being that boyfriend that's going to be nagged at all the time.
Yep, exactly. Where are you? Why aren't you home? What are you doing? Shouldn't you be home with your children? Yeah.
Do you love me anymore?
Oh, my God. The worst. The worst. So,
you know, I think not just me, but I think all the listeners out here, whenever you do have your first Tinder date, want to hear a play-by-play. So I think you should take a mic with you and just go to the bathroom intermittently and update us.
All right. So I'm going to say something. So I have a separate Twitter, okay, that nobody knows about. Absolutely nobody knows about it. I'm never, ever, ever going to tell anybody what this Twitter is. I talk so much.
Everybody knows the Chef Duffy fan page. Everybody knows.
Exactly. Nobody knows who it is. I don't have a lot of followers, but I talk so much shit on that Twitter, especially when I was first single. When I was first recently single, my ex-wife and I had separated, I met a tremendous amount of really cool people, and I met some really, really fucked up individuals as well. And I tweeted everything, Russell. Everything. Just left Blondie's house 3 a.m. Like, I mean, I tweeted everything. So I don't do that anymore because I don't go out much anymore when I'm home, because I try to be home with my family. But when I'm on the road, yeah, I tweet every now and then. It's kind of fun. So, and I'm never going to tell you who it is. It's that simple.
I love the fact that you have a catfish account. You literally have a catfish account.
I do. And I say everything that I really, truly feel, because sometimes, you know, I mean, in our industry with what we do and being in the public eye, sometimes we have to be careful of what we say. You know, I hate to say that, but we really do, you know, and their opinions. You know, I mean, Russell, you have a huge opinion about a tremendous amount of stuff, but sometimes we can't get out there and say that, you know? I mean, it's not like I'm going to tell you who to vote for in the election.
Yeah. I'm one of the guys that you can actually really, we have a private joke about that one, but
yeah,
I'm literally one of these guys that whenever I'm having to, like, you can notice whenever I'm keeping my opinion to myself,
because
I literally get uncomfortable. I get physically uncomfortable. You'll see me, like, my neck, I'll tweak my neck, you know, you'll see it in my face when I'm, like, keeping my opinion to myself. It is a tough thing for Russell Davis to do.
Yeah, big time. Big time. Yeah. Was that a semi that drove directly behind you during that?
was there a semi that drove directly behind you?
Maybe. You know, I think the best, and just so everybody knows, I think one of the coolest parts about Russell being on the road and doing the stuff that he does when I'm not on the road is the background noises. Because sometimes you're breaking up, and sometimes you're talking, we can understand you, sometimes we can't. And then you'd had this, like, you just had this whole thing about your opinion, and a truck completely drove behind you. It was pretty funny. So I like it. I like it. But I think one of the things that I want to do, if you don't mind, Russell and I have had a couple of conversations. We've been talking all week on the phone about a couple of things that we want to do with the podcast to make it a little bit more fun, so that it's not just me and Russell talking, so that it's not just us talking to our guests. Although I'm really glad and I love the feedback that everybody's given, the reviews that you guys are giving on iTunes and Audio Boom is actually absolutely awesome. We love it. So
thank you all so much.
So I think, Russell, one of the things that Russell and I decided to do is we want to do what's called a road rash challenge. So this started the other morning. I had a woman who lives in England who was tweeting about how she hated a small talk with some of her coworkers. And so I said, you know what you need to do? You need to get in there, and you got to kind of get in their faces a little bit. And really, you know, start to talk to them a little bit. I said, I want you to take a picture with three workers, a selfie with three coworkers in your office, and send them to me. She did this. She actually took a picture of two coworkers and her boss from behind. She took selfies, dude. They're on Twitter right now. Two of them are on. She asked me not to retweet the second one that she did because she sent it to me in a private message. But she's a super, super cool chick. I'm going to find her name right now. And see where it is. We had a big week of followers, man. I've got messages coming in crazy. Everybody loves the show. So
yeah, I know. Guys, thank you so much. You know, this past week, within 5 days, we were named top 35 new and noteworthy on iTunes. And it's literally because of all of our fans, everybody that's a rash hole. We cannot thank you guys enough for getting behind us. And we're going to do our best to bring you the best content out there.
That's it right there. So what we're going to do is we're going to do something now that's called the Road Rash Challenge. So we are going to post a picture, okay, that has our logo on it. It says Road Rash Challenge, and we want you guys to take a picture. The challenge for this week is going to be, so here we go. This is the Road Rash Challenge, okay? You guys have to take a picture of yourselves with a Starbucks barista. We want a selfie or a regular picture taken with a Starbucks barista holding our sign, and then you have to tweet that to Road Rash Pod, but you have to use the hashtag Road Rash Challenge, okay? So whoever wins, we're going to come up with a really cool gift, whatever it is, but the coolest part is we're actually going to get you on air during the podcast, and we're going to talk to you about it, and we want you guys to do the craziest stuff. And just so everybody knows, the challenges are only going to get either weirder or crazier, right?
Absolutely. And if you guys have an idea for a good challenge that maybe Duffy and I hadn't thought of yet, go to the @RoadRashPod Twitter handle and hashtag #RashHoleIdea and give us your ideas. We'd love to see them because we want to fill up the year with 52 great challenges.
Yeah, big time. That's going to be some of the fun stuff. And then we also, maybe Russell and I will do some challenges ourselves that we can do. I'll start a picture. I'll do one tomorrow, or I'll do one on tomorrow morning. I'll have mine ready to go because I take my daughter to school every morning and we stop at Starbucks. So I'm going to go in, I'm going to see JC, I'm going to see Ashley, I'm going to see Francis, who are my favorite baristas at my favorite Starbucks, and I'm going to take a selfie with those guys holding the sign, okay? We got that? What about you, Russell?
You know, I don't think it's going to be too tough, but I'm not going to make any promises on when or where it's going to happen, only that it's going to happen.
There you go. I love it. All right, so everybody, you're going to follow us. You're going to go to Road Rash Pod. You're definitely going to tweet us at that point, and you have to make sure that you use the hashtag Road Rash Challenge in there, okay, and tell us where you are. We want to know that, so you're going to take a picture with a Starbucks barista, selfie, whatever, holding the sign or holding a picture of it up on your phone or somebody else's. Who cares? Go and do it. Have some fun. We are super stoked to follow this one, all right?
Yeah. And like Duffy said, tell us where you're at. Tag them. Tag Starbucks. Tag the city you're in.
Yeah.
We want to know where you guys are.
Hey, Road Rash fans, thank you so much for coming out. This is me and Russell's second ever podcast that we've put out for you guys. We're super, super stoked about it. We totally want to thank the fact that Eric Castro came out and spent a good amount of time with us. We want to thank the fact that Brad Bohannon came out, hung out with us for a little bit. We want to thank all of you guys for listening to us.
And we want to thank all of our friends and all of our sponsors that helped make the Road Rash podcast happen. We want to thank Relax Just Create, Techno Solutions, Maggie Gagliardi, Unlimited Liability, CBD Solution, Audio Boom, The Mix Radio, and Council LLP.
Do us a favor. Please make sure you follow us. Russell Davis is very simple. Mr. Russell Davis. That's on Twitter and Instagram. That's two R's, two S's, and two L's. I'm pretty simple as well. I'm Chef Bryduff on Instagram and Twitter. And then do me a favor. Check out the whole Road Rash podcast. Tell all your friends to download it from Audio Boom as well as iTunes. And definitely get out there and review us. It's going to put us further up in the ratings, which is what we want, so we can continue with you guys. Thank you so much for coming out and spending your time with us. We appreciate it. Adios.